Hello, I'm Curtis Powers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. Subscribers, thank you so much for supporting what we do. You're a great blessing to us. Those that are fasting, thank you. Our country is worth it, and I think it'll be a great blessing to you as well. Those that are writing the thank you notes, and I encourage all of you to do that each week. One thank you note to somebody, and we're trying to recommend some people to do that too. But if you know someone in your area that's been doing something great and standing up for the truth, just a couple lines. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. It really means a lot to people. Those watching on Rumble, please like, share, and follow. We'd appreciate that. This last week, I spoke in San Jose, California, at Calvary Chapel there, and so many good friends there. Thank you. So many of you came out, and it was a great blessing, and I feel like I'm at home whenever I visit out there, but I appreciate you coming out, and we really had a wonderful time. Today, I'm going to interview Diana West. Very interesting info on the forbidden history of communist influence operations in our country and why they're still trying to cover up what happened long ago. And I think it's because it's still going on now. They don't want us to dig in and look behind the curtain in the 30s and 40s, because then you'll go to the 50s, 60s, 70s and to today and you realize it's the same thing. That's what's undermining us from within. But anyway, I think you'll really enjoy that and learn a lot. It was a very interesting conversation. But thank you so much for joining me today. A couple quick things before the interview. One, the AI reality. We had an episode on that recently. A friend of mine was asking AI some serious questions of history and things. And to their amazement, it was almost all lies what it spewed out. Even direct quotes from people that were not real and were not true. So it was really sobering to realize the power. It was a fake history with fake quotes by people that didn't say things. The sobering reality of AI is it can rewrite our entire history, all the textbooks for all of our schools in one day. Normally, textbooks have taken years for people to write, each individual one, for a seventh grade textbook or an eighth grade textbook. But now, giving it the parameters, which man always does, it's not just a system there to just give us truth and valid information. It always has an agenda, because people always have an agenda. It can now rewrite all the college textbooks, all the high school, all the elementary school, in a moment. And that's why it's truly so dangerous. So we need to pay attention to that. Some good news this week, the COVID shot has been banned for anybody under 65 years of age. No, that's not good enough, but it's a start. At least we're heading in the right direction. Of course, it should be banned for everyone. But now on to the interview with Diana West. And one of the people we talk about is David Horowitz. And you might have even read some of his books, because he was put up as if he had been a communist that had changed his tune and then come over to our side and written some conservative books and things. But I think you're going to find out that he was simply a poser, acting like he'd come over and to keep some very important facts away from the conservative movement and really understanding the level of penetration into our government since the 1920s and 30s. And they didn't want us to know that again, because I think they realized then we'll look behind the curtain. But anyway, I think you will really appreciate this and learn a lot. Diana West, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Curtis.
I always enjoy having you on, and so do the subscribers. Your perspective and your insights from the research and the writing you've done is always very interesting. And today I wanted to talk to you about David Horowitz and the forbidden history of the communist influence operations. A lot of stuff from your last Patreon video that I was watching, but you covered so many important things there. I just want us to dig into a little bit of that. Yeah. And before we talk about David Horowitz, talk a little bit about your journey as you were researching and writing American Betrayal. I think you said you started in 2009. where you thought you were going and where you ended up going, and some of that I think is really interesting.
Yes, well, I'd love to. I guess it all goes back to 9/11 in a way. I was an editorial writer at the Washington Times and just starting my syndicated column with it was just going to a new syndicate. So it was a big news moment, of course. And what I realized after 9/11 was that I did not know much about, if anything, about Islam. And so the next 5, 6 years studying Islam, learning the limitations that public debate was subject to discuss Islam. I mean, this was sort of, I think, more than, I guess I started, I'd been a journalist quite some time, but this was really the first real test. I think I was more or less in step with the public space on the conservative side going into 9/11. But as I realized that there were real speech codes on the right, everywhere that you could not actually delve into Islamic law, the impact of Islam, the way it spreads, spreads by the sword, convert or die, these facts of this 1,000-year scourge, I developed this notion, kind of a cultural notion that became my first book, The Death of the Grown-Up. The death of the grown-up being this cultural decline that we experienced just as we come up to Islam, which essentially it demands an infantilized subject population. So my thesis had to do with our decline, the death of the grown-up in our own culture, and yet here we are matching up to this totalitarian system that essentially we were sitting ducks for having reached this ebb or this nadir in our own development. So that's kind of where I was, and I realized it wasn't enough, you know. And I over time, I started thinking there was something else really missing in our society. And I actually was signed up with my publisher, St. Martin's Press, of The Death of the Grown Up, to do a book called The Hollow Center, because I just felt like I hadn't really hit it in terms of explaining this lack, this inability, this strange, I don't know, there was cowardice and there was childishness. It just, I wanted another whack at it. What was missing? What was there something I could learn in our past that we got that took us to this place? And I guess that was how I started the research for America Betrayal, as which was then the Hollow Center. What had made us hollow, I guess, is the question. And I had this experience where I suddenly realized that everything that was said about people trying to discuss Islam like adults, to borrow from my first metaphor, had already happened in terms of the debate over communism. And so Islamophobia, which is a made-up term to stop debate in the post-9/11 period, was red-baiting going back 50, 7,500 years in America. Red-baiting and Islamophobe, or red-baiter and Islamophobe, are perfect synonyms when it comes to people actually exploring the nature of a totalitarian system that is trying to destroy our constitutional republic. So I remember I did have this phone call with my editor at St. Martin's where I was saying, it's the center is not hollow. The center is not hollow. It's filled with communism. And that was basically where my own research was taking me. And so this became the new direction of what became known as American Betrayal. And it was probably in that same conversation where I remember saying it was a betrayal. It was an American betrayal. My editor said, wait, that's it. It's American Betrayal. And we went from Hollow Center to American Betrayal. And I think that it's very important for people to really understand that in all of our history dealing with totalitarian systems, because Islam and communism are very similar in their organization and in their antagonism and aggression against the individual, against individual liberty, individual religious freedom, equality before the law. I mean, these are both innately anathema to Islam and communism, both. But the way we have been deprived of these debates in the public square, both communism and Islam, is really, I think, the key to understanding how we could be so far subject to both at this point. I mean, this we're in a terrible place at this time, And I think so much of it has happened because the controllers, the manipulators, the people who drive narrative have been able to make discussion, debate, concern, fight, opposition to both Islam and communism in different phases, verboten. It's very hard to have, going back in time, the discussion about communism that it was hard to have about Islam. And now we are prey to both. So that's kind of, I guess, the arc of my own experience living through this, in some ways, both ideological struggles, having written about it in American Betrayal. I sort of summoned up the old red baiting hordes and or the people calling me names and so on. So I feel like I've had my own personal experience as a writer with both of these systems. So that's kind of where I am. Yeah. Is that a good overview? Is that explained
yeah.
what you were?
No, that's good. No, when I first read your book, it was my father had given it to me. And you people, if you haven't read it, it's one of the most important books in the last 25 years. And I always recommend it where I go, not just because I like you and you're my friend, but because it's one that even when you've studied this, my father started studying communism in 1961 and has faithfully done it. He's still living at 91. And when he read this, he goes, Curtis, I'm sending you a book. You have to read this.
Because
you dug into stuff that no one was willing to dig into. We knew about the big conspiracy of communism and they attacked McCarthy and stuff, but we didn't dig in to see how we were saturated with their influence all through our government and had been, you know, since the 30s. And so it's important for people to see that. But one question I want to ask you about that is, why is our true history still so forbidden today? Even 90 years later, no, you can't know about this.
Well, it's an abiding question I have. I think it must have something to do with the idea that we are still capable of being masters of our destiny if we know. And I think that in some ways it's encouraging that this history is still considered so verboten or forbidden because it suggests that we still have the power to do something about it. I mean, that would be my most positive, if I'm feeling upbeat, that would be my answer, but it must have something to do with it. They don't want us to know how we were taken down. And the only reason that could be is because we might be able to do something about it. I mean, that's kind of what I come to, but there may be other reasons. There may be personal reasons. You know, this generation has not yet completely died out, but it doesn't seem like enough. It seems like there's still keys to going forward that we need in this understanding, especially as it gets layered over with Islam. So that could be what's going on.
Well, what's interesting to me is, not only is it being hidden from us and everything, and they still don't want us to know it, but so many people that I truly believe are on our side and are good people, they still believe the narrative we've been told about all the stories of the 20th century. For instance, on your X account, Real Diana West, recently, Victor Davis Hanson, who's, I think, a decent historian and a sharp guy, in Hillsdale College, which I think does a lot of good things, obviously. You know, they were promoting their DVDs or something on World War II and how the Allied powers won and all this stuff. And you just simply said at the top, I regret to inform Hillsdale and Victor David Hanson that the only ally to win in World War II was the USSR, which is true.
Which is true.
But some of these people, I don't think, and we'll get into David Horowitz and say, I think some people were purposely covering, but some of these people aren't. It's like the narrative has been so pushed on us of World War II that even people that seem to study some things, at least, they won't step into this. They won't go, wait a minute, I think there's things we don't know about. I think there's declassified documents that tell a different story. That's what's shocking me. Talk about that, how it's frustrating to me when I see that.
Yes. Well, it's very hard to discern the good actors from the bad when you're looking across a spectrum of the right. You know, the right's where it's important, the fighting right. And that's where my own experience has been in terms of causing many to decloak in ways that they probably never expected to have to do, because there's a really interesting aspect to all of this, which is generational. I should not have written this book, American Betrayal, in 2013 with a major publisher. It should not have happened. And I would say that it happened because another thing that never should have happened going back a few years to 2007, which is when M. Stanton Evans published Blacklisted by History, his revision on the Joseph McCarthy story, with another major publisher, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Stan was in his 70s when he published that book. I remember him once saying to me, he'd really been in some ways working on it his entire life. It shouldn't have come out. He shouldn't have been able to do it in his 70s. It shouldn't have come out with a major. I shouldn't have randomly picked it up, because at that time I knew very little, if much at all, about Joseph McCarthy. I assumed he wasn't as terrible as I'd been taught, but I didn't have a whole lot of thought about him. And then I shouldn't have gone forward and developed the thesis of American Betrayal, which in many ways builds right on top of Blacklisted by History. Blacklisted by History is a book about Senator McCarthy. American Betrayal steps on top of that and then opens up the canvas, if you will, and looks at a lot more, but borrowing heavily from M. Stanton Evans' excellent repertorial / detective technique. And I will say that one thing, I got to know Stan Evans in the last few years before he died. It was a great honor and pleasure. And one of the nicest things and most amazing things anyone has ever said to me was when he said to me, I think it may have been the last time I spoke to him, and he told me, you were the reader I was waiting for. Wow. And I think, yes, and I think that literally that is true, because it was a catalyst for me, and I was able to do American Betrayal. And as I was trying to explain, it shouldn't have happened. I'm no spring chicken, but I'm much younger than these people who thought they'd basically put the lock on the history of the Cold War. And I think, literally speaking, it is a generational anomaly that this tranche of information came forward to us from Stan's book to mine. And there are some others as well. But it caused certain, and David Horowitz would be one of them in this category, but it caused certain people on the right who thought that they had essentially commandeered the history and repackaged it. And they thought their job was done. And who gave them the job and why they're doing it, I don't know the answers to these questions, but just observing the actions and observing the way this whole thing rolled out, which was a complete and total shock to me and many, many, many other people, it does seem to me that is probably the best way to look at their motivations. Something was wrong if Joseph McCarthy at all, the anti-communist position, was going to be rehabilitated. That to them was a terrible blow to what they constructed as the conservative movement. And I know this for a fact, because one of the things that I have in my up my sleeve at this point, I in addition to American Betrayal, I brought out a book, which I'm going to hold up, called The Rebuttal. And this book, this was a self-published book that essentially collects my rebuttal to the initial attacks on American Betrayal that David Horowitz's website Front Page launched by Ron Radosh was the initial attack. And it includes my rebuttal and the essays and rebuttals and defenses and such of the initial supporters of American Betrayal. And it was a fascinating, heated debate. I will say, on the positive side, and most of this is very positive, actually, I've never seen readers engage with anything the way they engage with American Betrayal and this debate over it. And in many ways, that is one of the most, kind of the highlights of the entire controversy. People I didn't know, comment sections were on fire. I mean, hundreds of comments, people writing essays on blogs and publishing where they could, because there was also a shutout. There was a cross conservative media. This was one of the very strange things. The Horowitz, Radosh sort of cabal, they were able to essentially shut down debate on many of the prominent news sites, but that didn't stop people. And so a lot of these essays are collected by others as well in this first book, The Rebuttal. I have a second rebuttal coming out, which sort of collects the rest of them, because this was an early book. And in that, I have all kinds of artifacts, including people who had conversations with David Horowitz telling me literally that the complaints about the book that were made publicly were completely different from what was really bothering them. And it had to do a lot with Joseph McCarthy. Literally, the idea that he really believed that he had developed a conservative movement. I mean, it's very grandiose thinking too, but that was essentially decoupled from the anti-communists of yore. And that did depend on essentially jettisoning the work of the investigators in Congress. Now, this was, as you well know, was Democrats and Republicans going back to the 40s and 50s. It was, defectors, and it was writers and investigators and various people creating this body of evidence to try to alert Americans to this infiltration, this subversion of our system. And so the idea that you would then create something of ersatz conservative movement without these people, without this body of knowledge, is to me absolutely kind of fantastic, but also I think goes a long way to show why we've been unsuccessful. You know, how the country continues to become communized, or if that's a word, communization, go Marxist, I think has a lot to do with the fact that people were never educated, across the board, the education system, the public square, the movies, the culture, the churches and synagogues taken over, etc. So their work becomes a block on our success. And I think that is a big part of this whole story.
Yeah. One of the pages you had in your site here, all the attacks, not all of them, but some of the attacks. Yeah, when I saw the bottom one commenting in your book from David Horowitz's site, McCarthy on steroids, I go, you have to be kidding. You can't even call yourself an anti-communist if you don't know right. The truth about Joseph McCarthy.
Right.
You would be like ignorant. It's like you're a math right. teacher and you're 2 + 2. I'm not sure what it is, but if you haven't figured that out. And so that I just is so powerful. Well, here's a quick, just interesting story. So 2009, I'm getting interviews for my film Agenda. And David Horowitz, who's been put up as, he was a communist and now he's on our side, whatever. I thought, I'll interview him, see what he has to say. So I set up an interview. I sent him, here's what I'm going to be talking about. He didn't read as a lot of those people are too busy. But I come to the interview. I've rented a room. I've got all the camera equipment. I'm there. And he comes in and says, what is this about? And I go, it's about the communist penetration of our culture and our country over the last 100 years and the influences. And he goes, well, what are you going to be talking about? I go, Antonio Gramsci and the moral rot from within that they were trying to create and stuff. He goes, you're going to talk about morality? And I said, yeah. And then he just started yelling at us and walked out. Because I'm going to talk about morality. I go, well, that's like the fundamental. They wanted to rot, break down the family, the structures, even the communist goals from the 50s, pornography and obscenity. They knew that just collapses the goal. And he just yelled at us and walked out. And I've wasted all this time and money. But right then I knew, I said, okay, that's a key. I mean, I'm going to hit morality harder than ever, because if you don't get that's they're trying to undo the fabric of our country because of our heritage is so strong in the Judeo-Christian beliefs. Then, in my mind, I go, how is he some big former communist And he doesn't even get that, or not even willing to talk about Antonio Gramsci and some of that stuff. And so I had a big question mark. That's my only interaction I've ever had with him. But then when I saw what was happening into your book, and there I go, oh, so he's one of those. Talk about that for a minute. Again, he was pushed. Those that don't know David Horowitz alive, you've probably heard of him. A conservative writer that used to be a communist. Now he's on our team, supposedly, and all this stuff. But who did you find him to be from all of this type of stuff in reality?
Well, opposer. Yeah. Opposer. Someone who had, well, just to back up just a tiny bit, I didn't know the man. And so, you know, because a lot of people looked at this and immediately are trying to come up with answers and, oh, it must be personal. Oh, there's some sort of backstory. No, actually, there literally is not. I think that I've looked at there, it's kind of funny, not funny, but there was another death in the same movement this week, the death of Michael Adine, who is a Washington figure as well, who figures in the American Betrayal story, not publicly, but I was told many times about his rancor toward American Betrayal behind my back kind of thing in conversation with people. So I look at them similarly at this point, but it's these people seem to have fanned out on the right and end up sowing chaos or confusion. And with Horowitz, I think that the, and Ronald Radosh, who was his friend, lifelong friend, fellow communists' children, they, one of the anecdotes from Horowitz's many, many memoirs has to do with the two of them being given a job on the Daily Worker to develop some kind of a youth page. And this didn't really go very far, but this was something he wrote about as having happened in terms of being planned. And the reason being was that his parents, David Horowitz's parents, were such good friends with, quote, Joe North, Joseph North being someone described by the defector Elizabeth Bentley as a talent spotter for the KGB. So there's a great proximity to Soviet intelligence in these networks, in these circles, going back to his parents' days. And so the question becomes, and I should tell you, and also send you, I did discover some interesting things. I think that there was an effort on the behalf of these people to hide exactly what happened that did affect their own persons. But it also played very much into the notion of controlling our understanding of the extent of the subversion. So you could say that they're protecting grandma, you know, figuratively speaking, but they're also preventing the American people, whom they have just said they've joined, from understanding how to protect their own grandma or their children. So it's not just some kind of family feeling that drives these people. But one thing I did discover, which is interesting, I'm sure you'll find it interesting, is that David Horowitz's parents were both secret members of the Communist Party. They were very active members of a cell in Sunnyside, Queens, New York. And they were teachers in the New York City school system. David Horowitz's father taught at a high school called Seward Park High School in New York City. And what I discovered that had never been reported was that no fewer than four members of the Rosenberg Ring were students there while David Horowitz's father was teaching English.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is.
It's really amazing. And it's not even all. There were other members, there were ancillary members who went through Seward Park High School as well. And it also happened that the leader at one time of the leader of his parents' cell. Now, this is not David. He was probably a small child, but still the leader of his parents' cell in Queens, New York, was the uncle of a very prominent member of the Rosenberg Ring, Morton Sobel.
I want to quickly interject here the Rosenberg Ring, what that is, in case you haven't heard of it. It was a group of communists who had penetrated institutions in our country. The Rosenbergs were kind of the leaders of it, but it entailed many different communists. But it was their ring that really tried to get the nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union and our sonar and radar and all these other top classified pieces of information.
So that's what she's talking about when she talks about the Rosenberg Ring. It was a very influential group of communists within our country doing everything they could to give all of our secrets to the Soviet Union.
And there was another, you know, one of the McCarthy witnesses, his name escapes me at the moment, but he also was in the cell at some point. He cycles through the cell. And you can kind of put this together when you're looking at transcripts or newspaper accounts. And I kept sort of plugging in Seward Park High School and finding that, yes, Ethel Rosenberg went there. And yes, Ruth Greenglass went there. And yes, I mean, the four names, I can send you my piece. I wrote a piece called The Rings Around the Rosenbergs. But, you know, this is something that he never told us. Now, that to me is pretty extraordinary, coupled with the fact that his friend Ron Radosh made his name as the latter-day expert on the Rosenberg Ring, and he never pointed this out, having gone into all this great detail. So they're definitely controlling what's going on. Now, the reason it does relate is the rings beyond the Rosenbergs apply directly to McCarthy, just because when he was essentially taken, assaulted and taken down, politically speaking, in 1954, he was investigating a very sensitive military installation called Fort Monmouth, and where a lot of the signals intelligence and so on was being performed and developed. And there were Rosenberg associates who worked there. And what he was looking at, Senator McCarthy was looking at, was the fact that some of these people were being removed as security risks by the general of the installation and then put back. So somebody was putting them back in, and this was going on in the hearings. And then McCarthy announced that he's going to be bringing in some very high level officials from the Defense Department, and boom, it was like there was an avalanche. And he was also developing hearings into the CIA, the nascent CIA. You know, there were a lot of things going on. They had to stop McCarthy, right? But the flack against him on these hearings had to do, oh, we didn't discover anything, there was nothing there, blah, blah, blah. And then later on, though, after his demise and even his untimely death, he was, 47 years old, I believe, 48 years old, in 1957, I think, when he died. But later on, Barry Goldwater wrote a book, a memoir, one of his memoirs, and he actually said, you know, McCarthy was right. This fort was so riddled with security risks that the Army just abandoned it and started a whole new fort out in Arizona. So, you know, he was completely on target. And so, again, if your drive is to somehow decouple anti-communism from the modern day conservative movement, all of these pieces need to be erased. Now, why you would want to do that is another question. It seems, strategically speaking, the best way to keep conservative movement from winning, or from fighting the right enemy, from knowing the right enemy. So, you know, where does that leave us in terms of our assessments of these people? It's a very strange thing.
Yeah. Well, at best, they're ignorant, and so you shouldn't be up in a position of influencing others when you don't get it. In my opinion, like Sean Hannity, I go, he's someone that doesn't understand anything about anything, but you're like this talking head that our side listens to, and to me, that's the most deadly of all, even though he might be well-intentioned, but he's just waving the Republican flag against the Democrat flag. He keeps it so surface, not digging into these things. You have to understand, or you will be a sucker for the next lie that comes along, the next conspiracy that comes along. Yeah, just, and I know one time he interviewed you, and he didn't know anything about anything. I remember, didn't he interview you on your book or something?
Yes. It was the Red Thread, which is sort of it's more like long form journalism, but I was trying to track the ideologies of the anti-Trump conspirators. And it turned out they were all, had been openly communists like James Comey, or voted communists like John Brennan, and so on. And there was a lot of really good finds in there, all from open source stuff. And I couldn't get any writers or editors interested in it. Nobody wanted to talk about the ideological dimension of this huge conspiracy against Donald Trump. And I finally ended up, and I don't know how, on a Sean Hannity radio show. And he had no clue, really. He was mildly interested. But the strange thing was, I was being interviewed along with Greg Jarrett, who wanted to smack down the whole idea that, for example, James Comey could be ideologically motivated. He just wanted to turn it all into personality. And it's frustrating. It's strange. You don't know if it's a, you know, what is driving this shutdown of the discussion. And I would, you know, enlarge that to include Horowitz and conservatives who are afraid to look at documents and open sources and understand that the Cold War was more than the Rosenbergs, who were, frankly, I've always felt, very minor figures in the atomic espionage ring. And Alger Hiss, you know, they want to sort of confine it to these two sort of signal events, which were very big events, but they were just the surface. And it's the systematic subversion that then carries on through the generations that is our problem, not selected people who stole some secrets. I mean, that's the other piece of this that I encountered. And the people who dominate Cold War studies, for example, there's a Cold War studies, some kind of a department or group at Harvard that's led by a man named Mark Kramer, who's sort of, I lump in with these people because he also joined in these same attacks. That kind of person, the men who put together the books on Venona, the Venona decrypts, which were some of the KGB decrypts that were released by the American government, etc., Haynes and Clare are their names. These people want to tell the story of communism or communist espionage without taking into account the most important aspect of these operations, which is influence operations, influencing policy, influencing war. This is the pinnacle of espionage, not the person who, you know, we see the movies where they, you know, are able to find the secret or overhear the conversation. And that, of course, that's part of it. Of course, that's a big part of it. But the biggest part has to do with agents of influence. All of them reject these very highly developed, very sophisticated operations that, in the case of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was mounting at the most extremely expansive and sophisticated levels. And they want to just ignore that, which, again, you have to ask the question, why? The answer can't be good. You know, it's not just protecting a fiefdom. It is a way of keeping people ignorant.
Yeah.
And that is, I don't know how to, you know, get around that.
In my opinion, just thinking through it, I think they don't want it exposed because it's still there. I think, again, we know, though, from studying communists, they pull along the fellow travelers and the like-minded. Yes. Well, if our government was just peppered with communists in the 1930s and were never uprooted, there was never a time, okay, we got to get them out of here. You don't think they were constantly pulling in like-minded people? I think that's what the deep state is, in my opinion. It's a bureaucracy that Marxism has influenced tremendously to truly believe America is rotten to the core. It needs to be done away with. Some of them are the higher ups that I think the Comeys and the Brennans, they were communists, not just in the past, but they were had worked their way into these huge positions of influence. And so if you started to pull back the curtain in the 30s and 40s, like your book does, where you start to see World War, wow, back then we were already that penetrated and things were not what they were appeared to be, then you're prone to keep digging. And you go through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, you go, wait a minute, you know, Ted Kennedy's meeting with communist agents behind Reagan's back and stuff. What are you talking about? I think it's just so much still there, although we're not even allowed to say the word communism, because what are you talking about? But that's why, in my opinion, from just reading so many different things and being and living through this time,
right?
I think they're still there. I think this influence is just heavy in our country. It's much easier today because they've so captured all the institutions of influence. half our young people think like a Marxist, even if they don't even know what Marxism is. But I don't know. That's my opinion.
No, I agree with you. It's my opinion as well. And I would say that there's the deep state, which is really, my friend Stephen Coughlin calls it the Marxist counter state. You know, it's more accurately speaking, we think of it in these ways. It replicates itself. You know, generationally speaking, these people were not expunged from government. Some were, but very few. And so they just hire each other. They ensure that they are represented in the next generation. I remember coming across, there was a set of brothers, the Graze brothers, G-R-A-Z-E. And there was Cyril and Gerald. And there was another one who was a New York teacher, I think was fired along the same time that David Horowitz's father's teacher was fired for in the 50s when New York State didn't think communists should be teaching in school, which was a wonderful time, right? But these brothers, I was reading about them, and they were identified that the Washington two had all kinds of jobs in the federal government. And they were later identified as Soviet agents. And lo and behold, their daughter or granddaughter, I just happened to see a news story that Deborah Graze had served in our State Department and was retiring after, you know, a long career serving in Cyprus and wherever else in the world. And I thought, this, you know, without knowing anything about her career or anything, but just look how this goes. There's no security check that would have said, well, maybe you should find another line of work given your family background, or, you know, it just to show the generational line of it. I mean, that's just one by the by, just having come across a headline, but it's incredible that, this was allowed to continue. And when you go to a John Brennan, I remember when he admitted he was doing some, what we would call now DEI recruiting, I think. And he was basically saying, well, look at me. I voted communist in the 1970s and I got into the CIA. Well, this sort of lit on fire the hair of some actual anti-communist old intelligence officers that I know, and you know, their first reaction was, think of the layers inside the CIA that allowed that to happen. So he was taking a polygraph, and he decides, I'm not going to lie because it's going to show, but he still gets cleared to join the CIA, which shows that whoever was taking the polygraph and his boss, they were able to say, oh, sure, a communist can come into the CIA in the 1970s.
And not just come in, but then work his way to the top.
I mean, go to the top.
That shows they have to be all in there, because any patriot in a position of authority would instantly go, no way, this guy, you got to put him at a side desk at the most, you got to get rid of him. We can't have our enemies within if we're trying to accomplish anything. Yeah, it's a stunning.
It really is. And this goes across the board. You know, it really does. So that was yeah. I think in some ways, you know, American Betrayal became sort of a catalyst for a lot of this rear guard action.
Oh, and absolutely. And even those of us that were well aware of communism and things, it made me realize I was still seeing the big picture, but was missing so many pieces of the puzzle. I wasn't digging in deep enough. Yeah. I was satisfied with knowing, yeah, they've been rotting us from within for a long time. Yeah. But then as you dug in, like, oh, okay, there's so much more here. Yeah. Which then it makes sense when you read it, you know, I know she's telling the truth, because it flows. Of course, you have it all documented and everything, but it puts other pieces together. Like, how could they be so successful if there's just a few here and there? But when you realize, no, it's at every level, saturating our government in any position of influence.
One of the things I was sorely attacked for and slandered, because the attacks were not disputes. They were not things you could talk about. They were literally disinformation, in the sense that people, they made things up. They made straw men and then knocked them down. They said, I said things, and then said how terrible that was. It was very strange to have to rebut that sort of thing. But one of the things that really bothered them was the notion that Harry Hopkins, who was FDR's closest and most powerful aide, he actually lived in the White House during World War II in the family quarters, was the notion that he had been a Soviet agent of influence, that he had worked and essentially been able to pervert American policy and protect communist aims and advance communist aims during World War II. This really bothered them. And it's sort of like more recently, I think the other case that really bothers them is the case of Robert Oppenheimer, the nuclear scientist. There's something there. They don't want the truth about certain very high level, powerful figures. They don't want the truth about them exposed. And again, you say these are events that are 70, 80 years ago. Why? Why is that the case? And I don't know if it because what it reflects about the president at the, you know, FDR, if we're supposed to be going towards some kind of socialist utopia in their view, and therefore we can't reject it. I don't know what the reasons can be, but there is this, I was thinking about, they're almost more like firemen with these big hoses, and they're just spraying, trying to stop any kind of information flaring up, really, and just put it out. And it's very concerning.
Yeah.
Because they're effective, and they essentially have seized the gatekeeper positions of our history. And so when you get to a Victor Davis Hanson, who you mentioned at the very beginning, I remember he wrote a column, and this was probably before I wrote American Betrayal, but I was already working on it maybe. He wrote a column comparing, it was a huge hit on Joseph McCarthy. And it had to do with Harry Reid. It was a horrible column, and I corrected him in an open letter to him. And he never responded. He never corrected anything. He continues to mouth those platitudes. And I don't know why. You know, again, it's the same kind of thing. He wrote a big history, the one Hillsdale was pushing, history of World War II, without noting any of the Soviet subversion that is now very plain to see. You know, it just, they continue recycling this rah-rah story that you learn all the wrong lessons from.
Yeah.
So.
The reality is, I wish you would do part 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
Going through the 20th century, though.
Yeah.
Then exposing the Korean War, the Vietnam War, all these different things that have happened, that our narrative that we even as conservatives believe, that's what we were told and we kind of go with it, is totally inaccurate. Every time I've dug into anything, I go, oh my goodness, even our stories, our conservative stories, they're not true. Most of them in the entire 20th century. Every little nugget is like, it's twisted or it's half truth or it's not quite there. And we just stick with it. You know, McCarthy was horrible. I've had so many people that call themselves conservatives say that. I go, have you ever studied that? Well, no, everybody knows. I go, have you ever read M. Stanton Evans' book or something? And they're, it's like they won't let go of the narrative, which is weird to me. Because normally I love to know the truth. So I'm like, if I think I'm wrong on something, I read something in your book, oh, I was wrong. And then I want to learn more about it. I don't want to, I'm just ignoring that. I'm going to stick with the narrative. But it seems like our whole culture wants to stick with what they've been told without even considering listening to the alternative.
It is such a conundrum. I mean, the McCarthyism thing really is irritating, but it takes time to unpeel it. And one of the things I learned was that McCarthyism really comes, the whole concept of a way of stopping debate, you know, just like Red Baiter and Islamophobe McCarthyism, it actually comes right from Stalin. The whole hierarchy of the Communist Party starting in Moscow ruled on this when McCarthy began his investigations. They went crazy, and it goes right down the whole conveyor belt through to the Daily Worker and their other organs like Political Affairs and so on. And it was Budenz, Louis Budenz, who had been an editor of the Daily Worker. He was an ex-communist. You know, David Horowitz's ex-communism to me is very suspect. It just wasn't a full reveal. You know, he didn't come out and tell things that anti-communists or investigators didn't know. You know, this is a big tell for intelligence work. If someone comes out of a movement and doesn't tell you something you don't already know, you're, you know, he's not a terribly valuable person, or he's holding something back.
He's holding, yeah, because you would want to, like a Whittaker Chambers, you want to tell everything you know because you hate this enemy because
right,
you've turned
you want
on
to
him.
Help vanquish it, right?
Yeah, and so yeah,
Right.
no, he, yeah.
But it was Budenz who actually wrote about that, and at some length about the background of this effort to tar anti-communism by using this term McCarthyism. And so when you see conservatives seize it and use it, it's nerve-wracking. I actually go through that. We didn't mention this book, but I have this book called Wake Up and Smell the Culture, which is a bunch of essays, and one of them is goes through the history of McCarthyism going right back to Stalin. And so how can that be? How can that be something that exists to this day? But it is because our educators, and not just the left-wing people who seize the education system, but our educators on the right, the people who sort of replaced, took over teaching the history of domestic communism, they didn't teach this. They didn't know it, or they didn't want to know it, or they didn't want us to know it. And so that is why I think we are, and partly why we're in such a terrible state of unpreparedness and cluelessness. And it's a terrible tragedy, but they played a huge role in it. And somebody like David Horowitz definitely did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think this, I get to travel quite a bit with things I'm doing, and more people are getting it. Even this last weekend, I was in San Jose, and so many people, we were talking about the communist movement and things that came up afterward. MacArthur was right, wasn't he? I go, absolutely. And so but many different people just in one came up to me. So they had just recently, as their eyes are being opened to dig in deeper and everything. I was a representative in Idaho in 2008, and I had written a letter to the editor on the communist movement, how effective they were being. And so many response letters said, a modern day Joseph McCarthy. I was just about five or six different letters that they printed. And I said,
McCarthy
yeah,
on
I
steroids.
wish. I said, I wish in response.
I know, I
I
know.
wish I was that kind of guy at that level. But when I interviewed M. Stanton Evans in 2009 for Agenda, at the end, we started talking about his book because it had just come out a couple years before. And I said, Mr. Evans, are you telling me Joseph McCarthy didn't destroy anybody's lives? And he said this. He said, Curtis, the only person that was destroyed by McCarthyism was Joseph McCarthy. They did to him what they were accusing him to doing to everyone else. And it, which is, and I just the way he said, I go, yep, I got it. And I go, and I told him I was just a representative a year ago, and they're calling me McCarthy because I was bringing up, I'd gone to this communist meeting, and I just had written a letter to the editor about what they had said at the meeting. It was at University of California, Berkeley. I just went to it. Here's what they said. We better wake up. This is real. And oh boy, the protests were at the Capitol, even in Idaho, demanding I resign because I brought up current thing. I was at this meeting. Here's what they said. Americans, please wake up. And the Reds came out of the woodwork, even in
They did.
Idaho. And it was pretty shocking how, just like, wow, even in a place where it's 90% conservative minded people. But no, well, okay, I think we better wrap it up here. But we're going to talk again next week about your new book because I really want to get into that. But American Betrayal and The Rebuttal are both available on Amazon. I have the links below. I got them from your website. And I really encourage you, this one in particular, this is one of my favorites of all time. If you don't have this, you need a copy for your library. So your kids and grandkids at some point when they're interested in what happened in the 20th century, they can read it. But you need to read it because when you do, it'll be so encouraging you to know you're right. There is a big conspiracy going. No, it does. It makes you go, okay, I knew something's going on. That's what made me make the film Agenda. In 2008, I go, why has everything my entire life always been going the wrong direction? Even when we have the Reagans in there and stuff, what's happening? And that's when I started really digging in and realized, oh, my parents had told me about the communists back when I was growing up and stuff. They were very active in the anti-communist movement, with Dr. Fred Schwartz was one of their friends. And so that's what made me go, oh my goodness. Now it makes sense because it just didn't, you know, if it was chance, it'd half the time fall our way and half the time fall their way, but it's
Right.
always falling their way. And then again, once you pull back the curtain, you see crystal clear. Oh, yes, they are so committed to their cause, their entire energies of their life, especially the ideologues that really believe in Karl Marx as their God. They will spend their last penny. They will give their last effort, energy of effort for the cause because they just believe in it in a crazy, unbelievable way. But how would people best follow you?
Oh, well, at this, I have a Substack, Real Diana West, and I have a Twitter account, Real Diana West. Actually, my Substack may say Diana West, but something like that.
Yep.
And anything else? I think that's all right now. Yeah,
okay.
And my books. And one thing also about American Betrayal quickly is that there are a lot of heroic Americans and other people, other nationalities who fought this along the way. And one thing I like about the book is, or doing the book, researching the book, was learning about so many heroes that also have been lost to us. We haven't just been hit, you know, communism hasn't just been hidden from us, but the heroes who fought it, many of them will be new names to people. And I think we take a lot of inspiration from them as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that was one of my questions I didn't have time to get to, but tell us about some of the unsung heroes like Major Jordan and other ones. But in that book, you'll hear their stories and realize there's been some wonderful people that never got recognition, but they stood up. Many paid a high price, but they realized, no, they love this country and they saw the rot from within that was destroying it, perverting and our State Department and foreign relations and things. And and it's important to know those people because their efforts have made things different. We're still hanging in there amazingly. My dad always says, I can't believe our founders were so brilliant to make something that even when you had enemies for 100 years within just trying to write, you're still around. It's a miracle. I mean, they knew, oh, we got to put chains on these people. But anyway, Dan, I appreciate you very much joining me today.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk with you. And I'm looking forward to next week.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Curtis.
David Horowitz, who was the supposed transformed communist to conservative, was just doing his part for the communist apparatus to keep all good conservatives from believing Joseph McCarthy was right. They didn't want that to ever come out. That's why they'll still attack you. When I wrote my letter to the editor in 2008 about the communist movement today, they came out of the woodwork, the Reds. There's another Joseph McCarthy in everything. Well, if he had to act like a conservative to get that done, so be it. That's what we don't understand, the communist mind. They'll have some people act like Christians and go to the seminaries and stay on and be the professors. They'll act whatever part they need to continue to push forward their agenda. They want the conservative movement to be ignorant and therefore ineffective in fighting the real enemy from within, the communist. You cannot expose the agenda, their agenda, without being a target. I'm not that big at all in the scheme of things. And yet my YouTube, Facebook, X, Spotify, and other accounts I've had all been deleted multiple times. Even when I restart them, boom, a week later, they're deleted. So that says a lot about how successful this movement has been and how powerful it is. Or even someone small in the scheme of things, but is speaking the truth and exposing the communist agenda from within, they're done. It's like my agenda movies. 25 plus million people in America watch them. I never had one piece of publicity from any conservative institution of any influence whatsoever. None. Because it's verboten. You cannot speak and expose the enemy from within because they are the ones controlling everything. There's a little more coming up of her interview. When we were done with the interview, we started talking and she said a few other key things. So I'm going to play that in just a second because they were very important. But I hope you'll get her books if you haven't and read them if you haven't. and then take that information and share with others. I think her book is the single most powerful book on the communist movement that is out there, if anything. But I encourage you to keep acting locally right where you are to make a difference and educate those around you. Keep praying for our country and all that's going on. So much going on right now, and I'll talk more about that in the coming weeks. But our verse for this week is John 8:32, which is perfect for this. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. That's why we stand up and expel the darkness of their lives, because the truth, when people finally see the truth, whether it's about history, whether it's about who Jesus Christ was or whatever, it sets them free from the lies. And that's our job. But I hope you have a wonderful week. Enjoy the rest of this interview. And until next week, God bless you.
You know, when Ladeen died, I don't know, for some reason I was thinking about it today, because I think of them in the same group, and they just did kind of fan out. And Horowitz really did. I have these emails. One of the people who was close to him at that time was the former prosecutor, Andy McCarthy. And, you know, we kind of broke at a certain point over this, all this stuff, but he was writing to me these very interesting emails, because Horowitz and other people were telling me this as well. They were lobbying people even before. Well, what originally happened was their front page ran a very positive review of American Betrayal. And then Radosh called Horowitz and said, I don't know what he said, but Horowitz took it down and scrubbed it off. You can't find it in the Wayback Machine. It's gone. I don't even know how you do that. Then it so happened that this lady who does sort of a news aggregator every day called Ruthfully Yours, she's a friend, Ruth King, she had grabbed it at 5 a.m. and put it up. So that's why we have a copy of it, because she had put it on her little site. So I was told eventually that they'd taken it down because he didn't know what he was doing, and they gave it to someone else to review. So in this sort of several weeks before the Radosh thing, McCarthy on Steroids, comes out, I hear it through emails that people who like the book are already being heavily lobbied, like, you know, kind of struggle sessions or something against it by Horowitz and Radosh. They're getting angry phone calls, multiple phone calls. I mean, just weird, even before it was just such a thing, and you just didn't understand the drive of it. And then you saw that queue of stories. They just kept, I mean, obviously those aren't all legitimate stories at all. They're just trying to kind of disorient me, right?
Yeah.
And then one of the big pluses that they didn't bank on was at the time, and this is sort of pre-Trumpian time, or for Steve Bannon was very interested in American Betrayal separately from them. And he had actually asked me, I did a 5-day series. We called it Breaking History. I did like 5 op-eds from the book, but based on the book, that happened to be running when the Radosh thing came out. So he was already interested and legitimately understood the book and liked it. So he was running Breitbart at the time. And so he basically covered the whole thing like like the controversy that it was. And he had both sides weighing in, and they were very big. Breitbart was really huge at that point. And so when I had to write my rebuttal, because I had a tiny website, I got to publish it there. And I don't think they were banking on me having any clout at all, because I was independent. I didn't have any,
yeah,
I wasn't working for anybody, you know, I was myself. So I had my tiny blog and, you know, whatnot. And they thought they could kind of seal the whole thing off. But that was a big plus. And it just kind of kept going and going and going. And, you know, when Horowitz died, the Radosh wrote a obituary, and they'd broken supposedly over Trump. So, but Radosh, he wrote this thing in The Bulwark, which is Bill Kristol's horrible, I don't even look at it, but, you know, it's like left-wing Republicans or something. Yeah. And literally, you know, he started quoting from his review about my book in the David Horowitz obituary. You think, wow, this really was a signal event for these people.
Yeah.
So he was basically saying, oh, it's such a sad thing that David Horowitz became such a right-wing extremist, but here was one thing good he did. And then this, so
Wow, that is amazing. It shows they were scared to death of it.
Scared
They
to
were
death.
scared to death. So it
Yeah.
shows that shows who
Yeah.
they really are, because why would he even care about your book? He's doing
Yeah,
his
I
own
know.
things. The fact that, no, this is dangerous, that proves to us he was not well-intentioned, because otherwise you wouldn't even care about someone else's book. Like, well,
Really
they,
wouldn't. Well, I
yeah.
think what was happening with the book was it really was, there was a very serendipitous thing that happened because I had met Radosh at a little event for this other book. Stan was on a panel talking about this book about Harry Dexter White at the Heritage Foundation here in DC, or I'm not here anymore, but there in DC. And I went to see Stan, it's right before my book came out. And all these guys were there, not Horowitz, but a lot of the others. And I met Radosh and we walked back to Union Station and he said, "Oh, you know, I hear you have a book and I'd like a review copy." And I said, "Oh, sure." And I, took his information. I gave it to St. Martin's with whatever else I had to get review copies out. And they didn't mean not to send it to him, but for some reason it didn't arrive. And he was too cheap to go out and just buy one, right? So he asked me a few times, gosh, and I remember, "Can you guys get him a book?" And he didn't get one. So the book had a time before getting completely slammed. People were reading it and people were getting really excited about it. So there was this organic thing happening because, of course, there was a media shutout in general, right? When I did get on book notes with it on C-SPAN, but by the skin of my teeth, there was a very nice producer there, and she, this was before any of the controversy, but she said, "No one will interview you on books on book notes. Why? Why?" And she said, "Because the book deals with McCarthy in a positive way."
Isn't that amazing? That's the
Isn't that
narrative has
amazing?
so penetrated people
So
that don't even know about the real issues, but no,
no.
you can't talk to McCarthy.
And they couldn't even say, "So what's your argument?" Or they couldn't even ask me about it. And so they finally got some guy who was kind of a jerk to interview me, which was fine. At least I got on. But it was so strange. So the book, but people were reading it, and I was doing a bunch of, promo myself. And then Radosh comes out. It's already 2 months into the life of the book. And so there were enough people who already knew what it was not to believe him.
That's right. And then
And
they
it
could
really
respond
was.
in the reviews, where other people would read the reviews. This is fantastic. I learned, whatever. So it's
Yeah.
hard to squelch it once it gets out.
Couldn't do it. Yeah. They couldn't do it. And then, the big moment was when Vladimir Bukovsky weighed in on it. And that was, for me, that was it. I didn't need any, Stan had written a great piece also. He'd taken a very kind of forensic look at some of it. And but then Bukovsky comes in with this massive essay about the whole thing and the controversy and how he'd been through the same kind of thing. And it was called Why Historians Hate Diana West. And it was at Breitbart ran it because Front Page turned him down, turned down Bukovsky. I mean,
Well, again, it exposes them.
It exposes them.
They were just supposed to be a vanilla anti-communist organization.
Yeah,
So when they say something
vaguely.
against your book, a lot of people probably, I'm sure some did go, oh,
Yeah, they
David
did. Yeah, a
Horowitz
lot.
is a, oh, so she
Right.
must be a nut. I mean,
She was
because
not.
you're, so that's what they're there for, to really neutralize things that are really powerful. And yeah, they may
Yeah.
push a couple little good things in the meantime to look legitimate, but they're missing
Yeah.
the main, like Sean Hannity, you're missing the main foundation stones, though,
Right.
of what you have
Yeah.
to understand the times. They don't have that. And so
Right.
yeah, it's making very ignorant people.